Working Cows Podcast, Episode 101.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. Here with another episode for you guys. Really excited about an opportunity to sit down with Brian Alexander. Brian is a rancher in the Red Hills of Kansas. He's got a great Facebook page, Red Hills Rancher. You can check him out there. But he was at the Grass-Fed Exchange and had his paradigm challenged, had his mind open to some new ideas and some new ways of thinking and some new practices and some new opportunities that he could implement on his business. And so he kind of jumped in with both feet this summer with a set of Coriani pears, and he has been grazing them through the summer. And we had an episode with him a while back and an opportunity to sit down with him and to talk with him about how that process was going to be going and what he was expecting. And we're going to visit with him today as he's just passed halfway with these pears and how things are going with him and what he's learned and some things he's thinking that maybe he will be able to see at the end and just kind of a midway update. So, Brian, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Clay, thanks for making the time to talk to me again today. I really appreciate it. Well, today we're recording this. Today's day 59 with the girls, so tomorrow is halfway. And I originally had projected to be all the way around, and I've got, I've got eight and a half days, according to the calculation, in front of me in the paddock I'm in before I actually go back to what I grazed the first time. So we're going to be looking about we're going to be looking at 68, 69 days of rest going back in. The recovery that I started to notice, and it's also pretty important to note, we've kind of had a record wet May and really, really wet June. July hasn't been very spectacular so far. I mean, we've gotten over 25 inches of rain in the last 60 days. So that's been pretty incredible. The forage recovery, you know, we stay in the strip about 12 days to 14 days, depending on which one I've been in. And as we go down the strip and get further and further away from water, I'm not seeing recovery. I don't see any recovery till they've been out for about 7 or 8 days. And then it just explodes. It just shoots up. It's pretty neat to see. So I'm currently grazing in something that's, you know, I haven't had any cattle in it for over a year, and it's kind of a chore walking in. You know, the grass is at least waist deep. A lot of it is waist deep, and doing it first thing in the morning when the dew's heavy on the ground. My pants are soaked from the dew first thing in the morning. The yuccas and the thistles are about cutting up my muck boots, but that's okay. I'm getting plenty of exercise. I'm probably in the best shape I've ever been in my life. It's kind of fun to get out and start the morning and walk through a bunch of cows and get a whole bunch of exercise first thing in the morning. It's the right way to start the day.
Sure. Have you noticed any, we're going to kind of work through this a little progression here, but have you noticed any changes in the land as a result, as far as plant species, biological life, any of those things sticking out to you yet?
I'm noticing new colonies of big bluestem getting started. I'm seeing some Indian grass where I haven't seen it before starting to come up. This is the time of year where my Indian grass, I can really see it for the first time. I'm probably less than impressed on the impact on the sagebrush than I thought I would be. I was expecting maybe a little bit more trample in a sagebrush, but that could be a longer term thing. The other brush that we have in that particular pasture would be, we've got some sand plums and I've got some aromatic sumac, and they're really impacting. They're really beating on some of those, especially when I put a mineral tub in it. They smash everything, and there's nothing left. It's kind of cool. But I've watched these Corianas and their calves eating sagebrush, aromatic sumac, sand plums, you name it. If it's out there, they've eaten it. Man, when they come off of, 3.5 to 3.7 acres, 123 head, 30,000 pounds of the acre stock density. When they go off, they're anything less. I had some range tech out from NRCS a couple of weeks ago with his trainee, and I kind of put him on the spot. I said, Carl, is this take half, leave half? And he says, oh, yeah. And I said, how is this for herd effect? And he says, I don't know how much you can get more herd effect. Take half, leave half, I think we're there. As far as the recovery, what I'm getting ready to go into, I've got a little more grass by measurement now than I did 60 days ago on what's already been grazed. So we're not going to have a problem making the back half of it, that's for sure.
And what about the cattle? Have you noticed any changes in the cattle since they came in? I know, I think the last time we talked was the day before or the week before they came. And then there were some posts on Instagram and Facebook about maybe them not quite understanding the electric wire quite yet and some growing pains there. So have you noticed any changes in the cattle?
Well, we took these cattle, and they'd been basically living in, I think it was like 900 acres for 6 months. So you've got a herd of 123. You've been living in 900 acres for 6 months. You've seen human beings twice. Don't even have any concept of what an electric fence is. And I bring them out here and I smash them into 4 acres behind hot wire. Okay, so the first week was a little crazy. And, you do what you can. You don't get frustrated. You don't get upset. You just, like Bob Kenfer says, speed is finesse. Slow down. Finesse them, take your time. When they get out, okay, fine, they're out. Just try to put them all in one pile and then build a hot wire around them. Leave for a couple hours and see if they're still there. We did that for a week. And I don't know how many times I rebuilt the fence. It doesn't matter, but they trained me. I trained them, and everybody's on program now. They're so well trained to the hot wire that there's been times I forgot to hook it up.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't bother it. Right. I can unhook it. The craziest thing is when I'm taking the fence up. So I'll unhook it on one end, and I'll hook the gate handle to my belt, and I'll start walking toward the reel, and I'll pick up post as I go. So they'll wait till I pull that cable past. They'll wait, and then they just walk in. They don't run anymore. They just walk in. We just went through. We just went to another major long paddock, I guess, long strip. Still trying to figure out what terminology everybody's using. But so we had to come back to the water trap, and now we're going back a different direction. So we're on the fifth wagon wheel spoke, I suppose. And it's been a challenge the last couple of times to get them to come all the way from the far end of the spoke back to the water to find, that fresh grass I just opened up. I've had to drive them before. I've had to use back fences before. This time I don't have a back fence, so they still have access to the stuff that they grazed on for the last 2 weeks. They just haven't chose to walk back out there yet. So it's pretty neat to see them just stick on what I go. That's the coolest thing I've ever seen, is just they stay in a pile. And I know where to look for them. It's real easy to see them when they're not where they're supposed to be, because right where to look. One of the other really neat things that I've noticed, and I did make a post about this on Facebook, is they've really been utilizing buffalo wallers. And for those of you who don't know what a buffalo waller is, when the big buffalo herds would come through, they'd create these big depressions and are usually kind of on the top of a ridge. And a lot of times the soil around it's really sandy. And who knows how many thousands or hundreds of years it takes to build some of these big buffalo wallers that are, 50 feet across and 2 feet deep. but they're so well packed, and the bottom of them is so tightly packed that they hold water. So they kind of act like stock tanks when they're full of rain. There have been times, Clay, that they won't even come back to the tank for up to 3 days at a time because they're utilizing the water in the pasture. They have to walk a couple hundred yards to grass and just a couple hundred yards back to water. Why would they walk, why would they walk a quarter mile back? They're kind of lazy in that way, I guess. But if there isn't good water, or the buffalo waters that get real shallow and real muddy, they have no problem. They string back to water and they go and, they just go in small groups, ones and twos. I've never seen them all hit it at once.
This is episode 101 of the Working Cows podcast. So workingcows.net/101 will be the show notes page. For sure, one link that will be there is Brian's previous episode, which is episode 88, where we kind of gave an introduction to this strip grazing experiment that Brian has been endeavoring on for the last, 59 days, he said. And so what was the management of the pasture that you're in before this experiment took off?
Well, it's called the bull pasture. When Dad took over the ranch in 84, that's what the previous managers had always used it for, is they just dumped their bulls in there when they weren't needed elsewhere. For a lot of years, it was divided into three paddocks, and it was part of a rotation scheme. For the last several years, it really hasn't been used much. In 2017, I used it just for a few days. But then in 2018, the only thing I did was I put, in 2017, like 2017, I had like 252 head of, or 250. See, you didn't prep me for this, so I didn't have this. I didn't think about this. It was 200. I had 200 heifers over there for 28 days. 200 heifers and 250 acres for 28 days. Barely tell they were there, especially coming back into this grazing season. Before that, I'd been lightly stocked, lightly used. This is probably the hardest this pasture has ever been used. I'm sure it's the hardest that's ever been used. Probably the hardest anything around here has ever been used.
And it's standing up to the hard use well?
I like it so far. I'm seeing less bare ground where I've had the shorter grasses, lower succession grasses. I'm starting to see a lot more taller warm season grasses creeping in from the edges, new stands and existing stands expanding quite a bit on the recovery. So that's good to see. That's real good to see. A lot of trample, a lot of herd effect. There are corners. Some of the far corners of the pasture, the farther away you get from the water, the less the pasture have been used. Well, you get down to some of those corners and, there'd just be an area of, a half acre of big bluestem that I could tell hasn't been used in 3 years. Hadn't been anything in it in 3 years. It's all, half of it's oxidizing and dead. Mm-hmm. Now that we ran the core innace through there at 30,000 pounds of the acre, it's all on the ground. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of leaf coming up. So, you can't let that stuff get dead and oxidized. It has to be cycled. You have to keep those minerals cycling, the biological activity cycling. And speaking of that, the cattle were wormed coming off the truck, which was a compromise. So they had to be wormed coming off the truck. Ideally, I wouldn't like to put any wormer on past April 15th. You're not really going to see dung beetles until about the 1st of June anyway. The dewormer takes 30 days to cycle and metabolize and get out of their system. That gives you about a two-week buffer before you should start seeing dung beetles. Didn't get that. Were my dung beetles late this year? I'm not going to say that they were, because I saw dung beetles behind the Corianes before I saw dung beetles behind any of the other three herds that I'm managing right now.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I knew what was going on with a dung beetle, why they chose some and not others, or if I just don't have a robust enough population to break them all down or what. I wish I had some of those answers, but I know they're there, and I know they're really happy right now. I just wish I had more.
It was on my mind. You mentioned being a wetter than average year, and that in our part of the world has typically meant higher fly pressure. But you're saying it's not a problem.
It's not a problem. It's not even really, it's not a problem on either one of the, heifers or the steers that I have that are on, they're moving every other day. You just don't see flies when you're on rapid moves because, you know, by the time the fly lays its larva, it takes so many days to mature and hatch right. into a new fly. Well, if the cattle are, you know, five paddocks away, you know, when that fly hatches, it doesn't have anywhere to go. It doesn't have anything to latch onto.
A guy that I was talking to said that, you know, you can break that parasite cycle with more frequent moves. So you're managing three herds every other day on two of them, every day, or maybe even more often than that on the other one. So there are some days when you're moving upwards of three herds. And how have you been managing that? What does that process look like for you?
Well, I kind of just settled into a routine mostly out of convenience because of, you know, the ranch is so spread out. Just have to cover a lot of miles. Job one every day is the Corianae. So that's like, that's the first project that I go straight for is take care of them because I know that's not going to, you know, I know that's not going to take very long. I know what I'm getting into with that project and, you know, it gets me fired up. I get to go look at them because they all look so cool. I get to go look at some really great grass. I get a lot of great exercise. That's a good way to start the day. So then usually it's, you know, if the steers are close, I'll go check, you know, whatever needs moved next is, you know, if it's heifer day, the heifers go get moved. And then I go check the steers and then it's often, you know, haul mineral. Because of the rain and the grass growth, I've just settled on a fast move schedule every other day for both herds. So we're staggered. So steers and heifer, you know, steers one day, heifers the next, then steers, mm-hmm. then heifers, then steers, then heifers. And, you know, of course, you got to stay in front of them, make sure your fences are up and get your fences hot and make sure your water, you know, every day you got to make the water rounds, make sure all your water is okay. It's a lot of work, but, you know, it's become routine. Sometimes it's kind of a grind, but, I'm happy with it. I'm really pleased with the way it's going so far this year.
Will you do more strip grazing on different parts of the ranch with more than one herd in the future, or larger herds in larger areas? Anything like that on your mind?
Oh, I should have known you were going to ask something like this because I've been thinking a lot about, you know, a lot of observations. You know, of course, you're always putting thoughts in my head with your podcasts and your guests. Would I strip graze again? Yes. Would I try to strip graze more than one herd? Maybe. Would I try to strip graze one herd and would I do what I'm doing again in another year? I probably would. But that's not the direction I'm going. I want less herds. And, you know, honestly, Clay, it doesn't, whether I have 100 cattle that you're strip grazing or 2,000. The only thing that matters, it's how much time is it going to take you to build the fence? Because after the first week, that's it. You're just building fence every day. And, you know, Bob would say it's recreational fencing. Okay, Bob, I get that. But I get a lot of exercise and I don't mind it. So, because the cattle are on program, you know, they know what's going on. I don't worry about them a whole lot. I just go out there and I do my job. I eyeball them, make sure everybody's healthy, got babies. You know, that's it. Doesn't matter if it's 100 or 5,000. It's just the feet of fence you got to build every day. Mm-hmm. And I bet, you know, Deborah and Emery from Birdwell Clark could probably say it. John Coleman Locke would probably say it. You know, it's just building the fence. That's it.
Yep.
So the people that are sitting on the figurative fence about strip grazing, it's really not that hard. I mean, you get a lot of practice really fast building fence. You get a lot of exercise. You get in good shape. But it's not hard. It's just work.
What other questions are you getting from people on Facebook and Instagram? Anything that you're getting repeatedly there that you want to answer in one place?
Not that really jumps out at me that I don't think I've already covered. People have asked me where, you know, some specifics about, you know, the supplies, the equipment I'm using, or, you know, how do you make a gate? And I'm more than happy to, you know, to take a few minutes and send somebody a message or go out and get pictures and say, this is what I'm doing. This is why I figured that this works here. So I'm more than happy to do that. Anybody that wants to contact me through my Red Hills Rancher page would be, you know, always happy to answer questions and give advice. Like I said in my last podcast, the community is about, it's about sharing and learning and, you know, trying to move forward and save the world together.
It's facebook.com/redhillsrancher and instagram.com/redhillsrancher.
Yes, sir.
That will also be linked at the show notes page, workingcows.net/101. You talk about people asking about specific pieces of equipment. I've seen you multiple times recommend the Cyclops fencer that Jacob Miller puts together. What's the name of his fencer?
His company is Livewire LLC. They're out of, yeah, I think they're out of Culbertson, Nebraska. If that's wrong, Jake, don't yell at me. but that Cyclops is a great unit. If I need any energizers anymore in the future, that's probably what I'll end up buying. I would definitely buy one of those over another Speedrider Stay-Fix. I wish I could find a stash of IntelShock 55s laying around somewhere, but because those are the best ones I've got, but you can't get them anymore.
You mentioned that they only had to be there a certain number of days before you kind of broke even on the investment of infrastructure. How has that turned out so far? Are you confident that you're going to be able to sail through to the next 60 days, some of those things going forward?
Oh, yeah. The math I did at the beginning said we should have paid the supplies and labor bill for the whole 120 days on day 34. So we're obviously way past that. As far as I'm concerned now, it is ranching for profit. I'm going out and having fun and getting exercise for profit every day now.
That's good to hear. And the next lap is a sure thing in your mind? There's more grass ahead of you than there was the first 60 days?
Oh, for sure. There's a lot more grass in front of me than there was when I started. And I'm ahead of schedule, or I'm behind schedule, depending on how you look at it. I've got, you know, I still have nine more days to go before I finish, eight or nine more days to go before I finish my first lap. So then instead of putting me at needing to cover it in 60 days, well, now I'm going to be needing to cover it in like 50 or 52 days. So do I make paddocks bigger or do I just not graze some of it?
I guess I've heard it said multiple times, never be afraid to waste grass. So
I don't think there is such a thing as wasting grass. It's just right. Save it, you know, stockpile it for next year, or that's next year's litter cover when you come in with 30,000 pounds of the acre of Coriantes and smash it into the dirt.
Where did you go to learn? I mean, what would you recommend somebody who wants to look into doing this? So what would you recommend for them?
Well, as always, I recommend holistic management training and ranching for profit. You know, but as far as specifics as, you know, strip grazing, building fence, just go do it. You asked me earlier about difficulties and challenges, and I was kind of surprised you didn't bring it up. We did have to send a cow home. An astute listener would notice I've been using the number 123, and the old number was 124. So we have a particularly troublesome Bob Horn cow that I suspect was partial Longhorn. The first 2 weeks, she jumped the auto gate. Okay, we'll fix that. We put panels across the auto gate. Went out again. Well, the next day, she'd gotten out again. Okay, fine. I went and I put her back through the gate. She didn't get out. About a week and a half later, and then at the end of another strip, I get a phone call at 8 o'clock. Hey, you got a black bobhorn cow out. Okay, I'll be right out. He says, oh, don't worry about it. I'll go put her in. So one of my neighbors put her in. All right, cool. The next morning, I'm literally on my way out. It's like 7:15. I'm on my way out, and within 2 minutes of being there, I get a phone call. Hey, you got a cow out on the road. Okay, thanks. I'm already on my way. I get there, same cow. So I put her in, and I fixed the hole she went through. Like, she just walked up, put her head through the fence, and just The rest of her body followed. She didn't care. That was a good tight fence before she went through it. So I fixed that hole. I go, you know, I finish my work for the day. I get home, 8:30 that night. I get a phone call. She's on the road. So we run back out, put her back in, kick the hole. Now, fat, you'd think I'd learn at this point. So we fast forward another 2 weeks, and we're at the end of another strip. 7:15. Hey, you got a cow out on the highway. You see where this is going. So yeah. She was out a total of 8 times on the road. After the last episode where she was out by the highway, like, she was out one night at 8. I put her in. She was out again at 11. I had to go back out at 11 o'clock, put her back in the dark. And when I got back out at 6:30 in the morning, she was in the ditch again. I called my buddy Ed, and I was like, Ed, we got one that's got to go home. And he says, when do you want her out of here? And I says, right now. She's crawling through the fence. So we had a particularly troublesome fence crawling cow that had to get sent home. So they loaded her up, took her, put her in a trailer, and took her back to Ed's place. And he said he took her like 3 miles back and dumped her with some other Corianes. And by the time they got back to their house, which is about 3 miles away, that cow had come through 4 other herds of cattle and who knows how many barbed wire fences, and was standing there in the corral, by the corrals, waiting for him to get back to the house.
Fatten me up so you can put me in the freezer. That's what she's saying.
No, she's saying, where was my calf?
Mm.
She'd had a calf the night before we roped her and sent her home. And we didn't know that for 4 days until we found the calf, and we were sure it was an orphan. So,
right.
So we saved the calf. There's a little bull calf. So that situation's our result. So every once in a while, you're going to have one that's troublesome. You know, you may just have to pull the trigger, put some rubber under them, and make them be somebody else's problem.
Any other tools you couldn't live without in this experiment?
Pasture map and my Kubota and my muck boots. My pasture map, draw my paddocks and pasture map, do one every day. You know, I get down to the tenth of an acre accuracy when I'm building my paddocks, because, you know, the difference between 3.5 and 3.8, you know, that doesn't sound like much in one day, but if you add that cumulative error over 60 days, well, that could be 2 or 3 days that you don't have. Hmm. So accurate measurements, that's important. You know, being able to get around, carry all my junk, and keep my feet dry.
What's some of the exciting data that Pasture Map's been spitting out at you?
I can't say it's really spitting out a whole lot of exciting data for me right now. I'm just, you know, it's just tracking my data, so I'm seeing, you know, where the forage is going and recovering. You know, it's really nice to be able to track photo points. It's a great place to be able to track photo points over time. I'm not really sure that was the answer you were looking for, though.
That's okay. I wanted the honest answer. So, anything we missed? Anything else you want to make sure we cover here before we wrap up and then look towards another 60 days and kind of debriefing?
One thing I never thought about was potential plant toxicity in early season. You know, when there's a lot of, you know, a lot of forbs, you know, there's quite a few of them that are toxic. And we generally, you know, it's not necessarily, it's been a long time since I've had an unexplained death loss. We did lose one calf, pretty sure it was a 2-day-old calf. We lost it to a coyote. And then 2 days later, I found another calf that was dead, that was at least 5 or 6 weeks old, and it was really puzzling, so I had to call the range specialist out, and we went out and drove around, and we talked about it. I mean, he was out for half a day, and ended up, he came back, and he said, I think that calf probably ate some larkspur, because there's about a week to 10-day window where larkspur is just incredibly toxic, and I didn't know that. So, yeah, I went out and I pulled a whole bunch of larkspur, and all of it I see, I pull.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a lesson learned. You know, nobody likes losing animals, and you know, even though I don't have ownership, it still hurts to know that animals in my care didn't make it. And something right. that I could have, you know, something that's probably preventable.
We'll wrap up there, and I don't mean on the sour note there, but I mean on the customer still happy.
The customer is ecstatic. He's very, very pleased with the condition of the calves and with the condition of the cows. It's been probably 10 days since he was out and seen him. I just talked to him yesterday, and he's very pleased. He couldn't be happier. We're also partners on the steers that I have. So we're kind of doing a weird gain rate deal on the steers right. that I can tell you about some other time.
Yep. Sounds good. Brian, I appreciate your time today, and I will want to hear something about pounds per acre from this experiment in another 60 days or so.
That sounds great, Clay. Thank you for having me on again. It's been a pleasure and honor to be on the podcast twice.
You're among the elite two-time guests.
I'll try not to let that go to my head. I mean, it's a good crowd. I mean, Dallas, Dave, who else? Bob Kenford. Mm-hmm. It's a good crowd to be in.
Aaron Berger, Steve Kenyon. Yep.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, thank you, Brian, and we'll stay in touch.
All right, sir. Have a good evening.
You too. And if you want to go back and listen to Brian's previous episode, again, that will be linked at the show notes page for today, workingcows.net/101. And he was on episode 88. That's workingcows.net/88. So go ahead and check that out. I am off at the end of this week to the Ranching for Generations conference. Going to see the torch pass from Dave Pratt to Dallas Mount. Really honored to be a part of that. Really excited about a tour of the Padlock Ranch and some of those things. So hopefully I get an interview down there somewhere with somebody. So we'll see what I come up with next week for episode 102 of the Working Cows podcast. Really appreciate you guys tuning in, and we're just getting started. So we'll see you real soon with another episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.